All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. We have a very special episode for you today. Now, if you heard the last one, you will have heard me interview the fantastic Richard Buskin. Now, Richard is a writer, journalist, author, and a podcaster in his own right. And back in 2012, he interviewed a certain Owen Morris. Now, if you're an Oasis fan, you know that name. Owen Morris was the mastermind who came and magically made Definitely Maybe Finally happen, and then came into What's the Story Morning Glory, co-producing it with Noel, and also co-produced Be Here Now, and is generally one of the most important people in the Oasis story. He's also someone that I'd love to get hold of, but I can't. He's not returned any of my calls or emails, so it's just not going to happen. However, what we have is a fantastic hour-long interview that Richard did with Owen back in 2012, which was then the basis of the Sound on Sound magazine article. If you just search Richard Buskin, Owen Morris, Sound on Sound, you'll find the article. But what we've got is a fantastic hour-long interview covering all kinds of different stuff, a lot of which didn't actually end up being used in the article. So it's really interesting. Slight word of warning in that it wasn't recorded for broadcast. It was a recorded phone call for Richard to take notes from. So the sound's a bit shaky at times. So bear with us. There's plenty of interesting information in there. And I've done my usual thing of dropping in lots of little clips. So I hope you enjoy that as we go. Not going to do any news and stuff. We're just going to crack on with the interview because I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. And we'll be back with a regular episode with all the news and all the other bits and pieces very shortly. But without any further ado, after this brief musical interlude, it is Richard talking to Owen Morris back in 2012.
Marcus announces that he's going to get Owen Morris to do a mix on spec.
Marcus got me in, because I don't think he knew anybody else. So I was very lucky to be in the right place.
And I'm thinking, well, what has he done? You know, I don't get it. He did one mix, and it was just outrageous.
The session, that's when I met Liam. You know, I told him he sounded like John Lennon. He's like, you got it. And like one in the afternoon, Liam lead vocal, rock and roll star. Out of my city, there's no easy way out. The day's moving just too fast for me. Noel was like, that sounds great, that'll do. And they let me do exactly what I wanted. And there was this new box, and you could make things twice as loud without going into digital distortion on your CD. It was in every fucking jukebox in the country, twice as loud. Funny as fuck, man.
Your background in the business, getting us to the point where you first worked with Oasis on their first album.
All right, well, briefly, I started working in a studio called Spaceport Studios, which is in Cambridge.
Yeah.
When I was 16, I got a job as a T-boy there.
Where are you from originally?
Oh, I'm from South Wales, Portobello.
Okay. So how did you end up in Cambridge?
Oh, when I was doing my O-levels, I just wrote off to every studio in the country trying to get a job.
Right.
You know, all the studios in the back of, what was it at the time, International Musician,
yes.
I think, was the magazine at the time.
Yeah.
Didn't get any offers at the time. So I had a couple of studios wrote back politely, but didn't really hear from anybody. But I started my A-levels, and Spaceport just rang up a couple of months into my A-levels and offered me a job. So I went and had an interview and started working for them, dropped out my A-levels. it was good. I mean, Space Ward was a strange place. There was, it was kind of a home-built studio. Mike Kemp, who ran it, built his own recording console, which Rupert Neve was very interested in. It was a kind of revolutionary one-touch routing design. But they got into computer graphics, and the owners got sort of sidetracked and developed a computer graphic business, and kind of left me to run the studio when I was kind of 17 years old. So that was good to me, and I was recording bands like The Stranglers and an artist called Dave Stewart and Barbara Gaskin.
Oh yeah, I remember when they were recording together. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was quite intense sort of learning period. Yes. Really, sort of.
So when would that have been? I'm trying to
think. 1986, 85, something like that.
Okay. Okay.
And I spent a few years at Space Ward, and then I think I worked with the Stranglers for a year or two.
Yeah.
And then I went to Manchester in about 1989, 1990, and I worked for Johnny Marr. About 4 years. I did it's the first electronic album I engineered and sort of mostly recorded just with Bernard Sumner from New Order.
Yeah.
Then spent a couple of years arsing around with Johnny while he was deciding what to do. And then Oasis came along, sort of 94.
Right. And how did that happen? Because I know, the problems they were having with the album, and that they'd already made two attempts, at doing
Marcus Russell, their manager, was managing Josh Marr.
And he also
looked after me for a while, but I was getting a bit frustrated working for Johnny, and I got a different manager just before Marcus got involved with Oasis.
Yes.
So the theory was I should have been involved with Oasis from the start, but they went in with a Dave Batchelor first.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think they kept one recorded from its slide away, something like that. Mm. And spent a lot of money, but the band didn't really know what they were doing.
Yeah.
And then they went in and recorded the backing tracks with Mark Coyle and another engineer, Angeli Dattel. I can't really remember the name, John, or something like that.
Right.
And they recorded the backing tracks. They didn't really know how to finish it because Noel had never made a record and Mark Coyle had never made a record, but the backing tracks were good.
Is it true that they, in trying to reproduce their live sound, they had no screening between instruments? And
I don't know how true that was. The multi-tracks I got were well-recorded sort of multi-tracks, with good guitar sounds and separation.
Yes.
So I don't think that's totally true, that myth.
And
they might have just...
Yeah, well, what about the story? Yeah, go on, sorry.
I think maybe with Dave Batchelor, they might have over sort of tidied everything up in a 70s style kind of where there's absolutely no spill and things like that.
Yeah.
And whereas when they redid the backing tracks of Mark Coyle, they probably just set up in the Sawmills live room and bashed the backing tracks out quickly live together.
Mm.
So that's what I think they were kind of talking about in it being like a live style. I certainly had lots of separation on the drum tracks that I was given.
And is it true that you stripped away some of the overdub guitars?
I was brought in to redo the vocals initially and try mixing it.
I see.
So I did the vocals first, but there was... I had to get rid of some guitar tracks to free up vocal tracks, because I needed sort of five or six tracks to do takes with Liam and then compile and then do backing vocals and things. But what had happened is Noel had just kind of blasted through all the tracks many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
fiddling away, really, you know, of which there was a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
But I had to make quite quick decisions at the time. I mean, I was putting things onto DAT with a Synthi track. Mm. So if I'd lost a part that was essential later on, I could always get it back.
Yes.
But I stripped out what I thought on very quick listens wasn't really that necessary. But then there were still lots of guitar tracks left.
Mm.
You know, because there would have. You know, there's a basic drum setup, one bass track, one track for Bonehead, and then 10 tracks of Noel, essentially.
Yes.
You know, plus vocal tracks. So, Noel basically had a technique where I think he'd strum the open chords, whereas Bonehead would strum the in bar chords. That was kind of their sound.
Yes.
And then Noel would do a pick inversion of that, and then he'd kind of just move up in inversions, I think, until he started playing lead lines.
Yeah.
That was his kind of technique for building the guitar sound.
Still in a total panic here, and you know, dissatisfied with the album, can't spend more money, and
I think it got to the stage where Creation didn't want to spend any more money on it.
Right.
So Noel, I think, paid from his publishing advance.
Yeah.
Like my mixing fees and the studio time.
Yes.
Which so he probably paid maybe 30, 40 grand out of his own pocket.
Right.
Out of his publishing money to finish the record.
Yeah.
That's my understanding. I don't know if it's entirely true. Yeah. I mean, I assume he got recouped and paid back quite quickly.
Yeah.
I think it was more a loan to the band from himself, you know. I think he had a pretty good publishing deal and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
So it was easier for them just to take control.
Yes. Yeah. So then, okay, you know, the next album, are you automatically approached, you know, that they want you to do that next album?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I kind of stopped working for Johnny Marr around then, and we did some B-sides, and we recorded Whatever, the Christmas single.
Yes.
And that was kind of the first time you recorded all the band. That was easy. That was a good session. We did B-sides like Listen Up and Fade Away.
Mm.
And we demoed, some might say, and we recorded Whatever in all about 5 days. It was a very creative session. And then with the intention of going ahead and me making the next record. I mean, there wasn't really any A&R input from Creation with Oasis. I think Alan McGee listened to the initial songs, but I think he went into kind of rehab or something.
Yes.
During the making of Definitely Maybe. So I never really saw Alan McGee in the studio until maybe one time he came in to listen to Morning Glory at near the end.
Right.
So it was basically Noel choosing the songs and running the band.
Yes.
With Marcus Russell managing.
Okay.
You know, the whole thing. You know, Marcus acting as management stroke record company, essentially.
Well, yeah, So, okay, and then was it from the get-go that you were going to be producing, co-producing with them?
Yeah, co-producing with Noel.
Yeah.
I mean, Noel really had it sussed with arrangements and song choice, but he wasn't experienced in the studio.
Yeah.
So I kind of filled in the gaps, really, you know, as far as putting takes together and overdubbing methods and getting vocals done, which was quite important, because Noel wasn't really that into spending time.
Yeah.
Once he'd shown Liam the song, he just dug it off and let Liam sing, which was fine, actually. It was a cool way of doing it.
Mm.
But, you know, I'd be producing the vocals, to compile the vocals and tune or whatever, you know, so that'd be down to me. And just general production techniques, you know, basic production techniques, was just filling in the gaps.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah. So, now, you were engineering as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wasn't a very good engineer, but I was engineering, yeah. I wasn't very technically adept. But I didn't really like working with anybody else, because it was always quicker to do it myself.
Yeah.
In my sort of basic little way.
Yeah. And was this your first production gig?
No, my first good production gig. I mean... Mm. I produced some local Cambridge bands back in Spaceward.
Yes.
And I co-produced an album with The Bible. I don't know if you remember them. They were
Boo
Hewardine.
Yes.
I'm not sure if my album ever came out. I think they might have been dropped, actually, by Chrysalis. But I was doing odds and ends. And you know, the stuff I was kind of semi-co-producing with Johnny Marr and Bernard Sumner anyway, so this just made it sort of official, really.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay, so then the choice of venue, which was Rockfield, wasn't it, in Wales?
Yeah, well, after I did Deathly Maybe, I went in with The Verve and did Northern Soul.
Yeah.
The Verve's second album, which is a good record. It's quite traumatic, but a good record. And we did that at Loco, which was in South Wales, near Caerleon.
Okay.
Near Newport. And I did that record between sort of October 94, fucking hell, and sometime in 1995. And then we recorded Some Might Say in Loco just after I finished the Verve record.
Yeah.
And that was the last session with Tosh McCarroll. I think we did Some Might Say in Acquiesce, something like that.
Yes.
That week.
Some might say that sunshine follows thunder. Go and tell it to the man who cannot shine. Some might say that we should never ponder on our thoughts today, 'cause they hold sway over time. Some might say we will find day. Some might say we will find a brighter day.
Yeah.
'Cause I've been standing at the station in need of education in the rain. You made no preparation for my reputation once again. The sink is full of fishes, she's got many dishes on the plane. It was overflowing gently, but it's all elementary, my friend.
I don't know, I'd got a bit bored with Loco, and having the offer of going to Rockfield, which was a better studio, you know, bigger recording rooms, better accommodation, that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Was a great thing. It was somewhere I'd always wanted to record, you know, coming from Wales and seeing that name on lots of records and stuff like that. So being able to go to Rockfield was just a great thing. So we had the budget, Marcus put together the budget for us to go in there for 6 weeks and record, which was fantastic.
Yeah. What was the equipment set up at that time, do you recall?
In Rockfield?
Yes.
The recording equipment?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a big Neve VR, one of the last desks, you know, those ones.
Yeah.
With the flying faders and all that. I don't think the output had changed in years and years. It was an old pair of JBLs and the monitors, which are probably still there.
Yeah.
Because Kingsley never changed them, because they're just loud. I mean, they're harsh and loud.
Yes.
Quite, you know, but good for sort of recording rock and roll, really.
Hmm.
And a standard set of boards, you know, sort of Uris and BBXs and stuff, and a bunch of old Neve, Mike Amps and EQs. Very standard stuff.
What about the tape machine?
A couple of Studer A820s, I think.
Okay.
You know, some good tape machines.
Yes.
So Rockfield was... I mean, the only thing I think has changed about Rockfield these days is the desks. Of, he sold the Neves at some stage, didn't he, I think?
To
downgrade or pay off his bank loans or whatever, you know, so...
Yes.
But those Neves were great at the time, you know. They big working desks.
Yeah. So, okay, so now also, you know, approaching the album, did... Noel, you know, have, you know, material ready written?
Yeah, I mean, I remember him telling me on the Some Might Say session, which was kind of March time, and we started Morning Glory at the start of May, so there's only like a month in between, or 2 months in between.
Yes.
But he had songs like Hello and She's Electric, years and years.
Yes.
You know, they're some of his first songs he'd written, I think.
Yeah.
And I think he just wrote Roll With It. I think he had the chord chains for Champagne Supernova knocking around for a while. As I say, some might say he demoed a year before.
Yeah.
You know, the song, the structure was there, the words were there. I think the songs he came in fairly new with were Don't Look Back in Anger, which I think he wrote just before. I think they did a Sheffield Arena gig about a month before going in to record Morning Glory. I think that's when he played it for the first time, just himself. Wonderwall we didn't hear until the week of the session.
Yeah.
And he played it to me, I think, on the first day.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just checking the arrangement. He had a more complicated arrangement, alternate arrangement.
Yes.
But we settled on the simpler arrangement.
Okay.
The other songs on this, Morning Glory, I think he had the riff written and pretty much most of the song written, but he wasn't really playing it to anybody until the week of the session. We went into routine, you know, rehearse the week before Morning Glory. I think they only really practiced Roll With It and Hello. And that was basically to say, I think that was basically them sort of wanted to spend a tiny bit of time with Alan White before they did anything.
I see.
Because, you know, he joined a week before they started recording.
Yes. And when you say that Wonderwall, you know, there was the more complex arrangement, you went with the simpler one. What, you know, can you summarise what the more complex one would have been?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I remember him playing it to me once, and I think he had a slightly different way of getting into the bridges and a kind of instrumentally bit after the first chorus, which sounded unnecessary to me.
Yes.
Sounded overcomplicated.
Yes.
But I think he had the song as was anyway, but he was just trying these other couple of bits. And it was fairly quick for us, I suppose, to say, no, let's not bother with that.
Yeah.
Today was gonna be the day they were gonna throw it back to you. by now you should have somehow realized what you got to do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. A backbeat, the word was on the street that the fire in your heart went out. And I'm sure you heard it all before, but you never really had a doubt. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Wait, you know, because you gave me your background, but you know, we were just talking about studios and stuff. In terms of the musicality, the musical side of things, and, you know, arranging and stuff like that, is that something you just kind of learned on the fly, or did you have a background in that?
No, I mean, but I've been, you know, recording since, I've been recording for 10 years by then.
Yes.
I've been in the studio non-stop.
Yeah.
I learned an awful lot of Johnny Marr, to be honest.
See. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Johnny Marr had the most amazing record collection.
Yeah.
And he was just a complete music head, so he'd be playing music all the time. And for the 4 years I worked for him, we didn't really stop recording music, even though very little of it ever came out. So I did a lot of learning with Johnny. So I kind of put all these tricks together, really.
Mm.
And Noel was fantastically musical. You know, he had it all anyway, but all he needed was a bit of trimming around the edges and guidance as to how to structure the dynamics of a recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bernard Summer I learned a lot from as well. You know, watching Bernard write and record at the same time.
Yes.
With keyboards
yep.
was a fascinating thing. Seeing how songs were constructed and, you know, how dynamics work, going into choruses and all
yes.
that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And Noel's songs were quite classic arrangements.
Mm.
So the dynamics were fairly obvious, really.
Now, also, the fact that, you know, this album had, you know, string arrangements, more varied instrumentals and instrumentation, I should say, was that something
that was
up front, or did that evolve?
Well, I'd started playing. I always had a computer running. I always had Cubase running, even when I was doing Definitely Maybe.
Yes.
Mixing Definitely Maybe. Whether to add on bits of percussion or the sampled sort of guitar tones sometimes, or just have around. I'd always be playing with stuff. I think we put bagpipes on something at one stage. Stuff you can't really hear, but it's there.
Yeah.
That's because I, you know, working with Bernard Sumner and Johnny Marr, it was all computer, really. So my background was recording traditionally, but then I went through a phase of computer stuff, lots of MIDI things.
Yes.
So I always had a computer on the go. And with The Verve, there were quite a few tracks like History and, maybe not quite a few tracks, but History, where I did all, I played with a computer and did analog sort of string synth sort
yeah.
of stuff.
Yeah.
So on Morning Glory, we got a Mellotron in. I had an old Kurtz file around, and I was always running my computer. Everything was to click, so it was always to my computer. You know, the tracks and arrangements. So I always had my computer running. So I was always fiddling with strings, and there are more strings on some things. And there are no strings on some things. But they're always kind of around. And Noel seemed quite up for that at the time.
Yes.
I mean, it later turned into them using big string sections and stuff on Be Here Now. But on Morning Glory, it was just me playing stuff.
Yeah.
I think Bonehead insisted on playing, like, the cello part, which I came up with on Wonderwall.
Okay.
And then I added a bit more to it later, but whatever. You know. Ha!
So
it was for him to do something.
So, okay, so let's start with, what order did they go down? Which came first? Was it Wonderwall or was it Champagne Supernova?
Well, I think the first week's quite almost well documented. Hmm. We went in on a Monday, and on the first day we recorded Roll With It.
Yeah.
Apart from a few overdubs, maybe a bit of like Noel's extra R's and stuff on the guitar solo. Pretty much recorded the first day. Then on the second day we did Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all recorded and done. Then on the third day, that was when Noel said to Liam, which one do you want to sing? Do you want to sing Wonderwall or do you want to sing Don't Look Back in Anger?
Yeah.
And I think because Noel had already sang Don't Look Back in Anger, or whatever the reason, Liam said he'd sing Wonderwall.
Yeah.
So Noel said, right, he's going to sing Don't Look Back in Anger then.
Yeah.
Noel hadn't made the decision he was going to sing one of them. So we recorded Wonderwall that day. Pretty much finished it apart from the one little piano tinkly overdub at the end. That was recorded in like 8 hours, maybe less.
Okay, so now...
Then I'll,
yeah, sorry, well, let's get into that first of all. When you said it was recorded on that day, so what was the setup in terms of recording them? Where were they all positioned and how were they mic'd?
Well, the only track that was recorded live as the band playing together, I think, was Roll With It.
Okay.
Because that was basically just a band, me getting the band set up. There was a drum room. I think it's called the Coach House we were in at, the Coach House at Rockfield. There are two studios there.
Mm.
So there's the drum room right in front of the control room. So
yeah.
Alan White's positioned there on the drum riser. Quite a very basic drum setup. You know, he had a little Gretsch drum kit that I wasn't particularly fond of, but he loved. So it was very, you know, a very basic mic setup on it.
What would it have been, the miking setup?
I mean,
at that time, then, if you were just to kind of guess, what would it have been?
Oh, I'm very simple. I had things like an RE20 on the bass drum, probably a couple of SM57s on the snare.
Yeah.
Probably things like U47s on the toms.
Yes.
If I was being posh, and I think it's stereo C12 on overheads. I don't think I even liked the hi-hat. I was being very basic.
Yes.
And then a couple of ambient mics. You know, very simple stuff going on.
I mean, was that your usual approach with drums, or was there a specific reason for making it straightforward like this?
No, that was probably my usual approach at the time. I probably used a similar setup with Pete Salisbury from The Verve.
Okay.
Earlier.
Mm.
Certainly not over miking, certainly under miking. But I think that was from recording on analog 24 tracks, just trying to keep the tracks down.
I see.
You know, trying to keep tracks under 8 tracks and things like that.
Yeah.
Which obviously was changed later when we, you know, discovered we can have more and more tracks and things. But there was probably 8 drum tracks maximum.
I see. That was
a hangover.
Oh, I see, because I thought you said you had two 820 machines. I thought you were recording...
Ah, right. Well, up until then, the Verve was recorded on 24-track.
Yeah.
Some I'd say was 24-track.
Yeah.
And it was only when we went into Morning Glory that we went to 48-track.
Okay.
But my setup was still sort of the mindset of 24-track. So I probably had 8 drum tracks.
Yes.
A mic on the bass amp plus a DI... Another couple of tracks.
Yeah.
Couple of tracks for Bonehead's amp, a couple of tracks for Noel's basic amp, so you're up to like 14 tracks or whatever.
What mics would you use on the bass amp and the guitars?
Again, probably very simple mics, something like an RE20 I've always liked on a bass amp.
Yeah.
And guitars, very simple again, SM57s and a U87 on whatever amps are around. A 57 plus a posh mic, basically.
Right. And so
very, very simple.
And so for the Wonderwall, what would you have started with, like drums and bass? How would you have?
No, well, after we recorded Roll With It on the first day,
yeah,
I kind of had a word with Noel and said we need to sort of work to a click. it was actually the first take they did, setting up live, for them to just give me comments about their headphone mixes and things like that.
Yeah.
We ended up keeping the first take. They did another half a dozen takes, but I ended up liking the very first take. That's the backing track we kept. It was just to save time. It was like, oh my god, we could really arse around for a long time with these tracks the band don't really know. If they have to learn them every day and then do multiple takes, which I then have to edit together. So I said to Noel, we should do it to a click, and we should do it as I think I'd read that Mark Boland's T-Rex tracks, which convinced Noel it was a good idea.
Yeah.
He'd do an acoustic guide, vocal and acoustic guitar guide to a click.
Okay.
And then the rest of the band would overdub individually afterwards. So every morning, Noel and I would find the tempo for the song, whichever we were doing. So the next day we did Hello.
Yeah.
On our Wonderwall, we've got the tempo for the song. Noel would do an acoustic guitar take, and then he'd do a guide vocal take along to the click.
Okay.
And then Alan White would overdub along to that. And Noel would sit in the studio watching Alan White and directing him as to where the fills are coming up.
Okay.
So there was very little rehearsal. So we'd basically go straight into record.
Mm.
And if Noel didn't like the sound of what was happening, or it didn't, you know, go with the dynamics of the song, what Alan was doing, we'd stop and we'd just rewind and drop in.
Yes.
So we'd have a drum track within maybe half an hour of Alan starting, you know. You know, he'd listen through to the arrangement, obviously, and he'd have the arrangement in front of him. He'd maybe have a couple of playthroughs.
Yes.
Before actually recording, is the truth, you know. But it was very, very quick.
Yeah.
And then usually Noel would put the bass down. I think Griggs played bass on maybe a few tracks. But Griggs, you know, God bless him, wasn't the best musician in the world. You know, he's great live and stuff, but it was just quicker for Noel to do a bass take, which Noel will do in one or two takes,
yes,
with maybe a couple of drop-ins for, you know, a couple of bits of time in here and there. So things would happen very, very quickly. You know, so by midday you'd have drums and bass down. And then either, if Bonehead was playing electric guitar, he'd get his takes down very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd normally probably get two tracks of Bonehead down.
Yeah.
And so that'll be another half an hour to an hour maximum.
Yes.
And then Noel would overdub maybe three, four, five guitar parts if they were electric tracks.
Okay.
So with Wonderwall, we'd have the drums and bass down, as I say, by midday, 1 o'clock. I think Noel would probably overdub three or four acoustic guitars then.
Yes.
Probably three. I think three was the magic number at the time, whatever, for whatever reason. Liam might have sang it very quickly. I think Liam was quite keen to get in and sing it. So Liam would have sang just to acoustic guitars, drums and bass.
Yes.
And he'd have done four takes of it. I was just doing four takes of him at the time and compiling quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was I'd always auto-tune him as well. I was using a, it wasn't auto-tuned at the time, it was a Eventide DSP-4000 pitch quantize.
Right.
Which was just out around that year or something.
Yeah.
But it just helped just to get takes down, and then just sort of, if there are any lines that he was slightly out, I could just pull him in slightly. And everyone seemed happy with that. I used it all the time on Death and Baby, so I used it all the way through Morning Glory as well.
What did you like it with?
I used a Neumann FET 47 for all of Morning Glory.
Right, okay.
I think from the mixing, it's a bit sibilant. I don't think I DS'd him enough on the mixing. But anyway, yes, but it was a FET 47 all the way.
And did you employ, you know, much effects on his vocals?
I beg your pardon?
Did you employ many effects on the vocals?
On mixing, I compressed it down. I probably used a Urey 1176 going down, and then I can't remember what I used on the mixing. Probably similar. But there was always like a tape delay going on for me with mixing. And a couple of reverbs. I probably used less and less effects as I went along. Definitely tape delay.
Yeah.
Backbeat, the word is on the street that the fire in your heart is out. I'm sure you've heard it all before, but you never really had a doubt. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. And all the roads we have to walk are winding, and all the lights that lead us there are blinding. There are many things that I would like to say to you, but I don't know how.
I was watching his performance at the closing ceremonies of the Olympics, and, you know, he sounded really nasal to me with his vocal.
Yeah, he didn't sound too brilliant, did he? But he hasn't been, I don't know how much he's been singing at the moment, but you know, when I was recording Liam, he was singing really well.
Right.
And his voice was very open.
Right.
So he was doing takes very, very, very confidently and very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, he was so easy to record.
And was Noel happy with what he was doing on that song?
Oh, loving it, absolutely, totally happy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So Wonderwall got finished very, very quickly. I think it was after we had the vocal that, you know, the Mellotron was there, and it was like, well, Bonehead wasn't going to play his usual strum along bar chords on this track. So I went and picked out the root notes, showed him where those were, and then just got him to play those on the cello sound, which we all liked.
Yeah.
And I think we picked out a harmony for the bridge and chorus to build it and things like that. I think I did the delays. I think we were finished by, you know, dinner time.
Wow.
Really.
Wow.
There's one little piano line which comes in at the end. I think Noel did a few weeks later.
Yeah.
Where we just said it just needs something, you know, anything.
Yeah.
To sort of keep it going.
Yes.
Okay. So that was very, very, very easy.
Now, what about Champagne Supernova?
Well, the next day we did Don't Look Back in Anger.
Okay.
Pretty much on the same basis as Wonderwall. It probably went longer into the night because there were more electric guitars on it.
Mm.
And I put quite a few more string parts on it. So that would have been a genuine 14-hour session, whatever, to get it pretty much done.
When you were listening to this material, by the way, at the time, were you sort of thinking it's, you know, a bit derivative, it sounds a bit Beatle-ish, or, you know, that intro sounds like Imagine?
But that was funny. I mean, you know, Noel got Bonehead to play it like Imagine. That made us all sort of laugh, you know, so no one really cared about that. It was funny.
Yes.
And the whole sort of derivative sort of Noel Gallagher Beatles thing, he was quite happy to be compared to the Beatles, very much, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so all that was quite a bit of a joke, really, you know, and just made everybody laugh.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so all right, so as you said, so Don't Look Back in Anger went down pretty straightforward, and what about with Noel's vocal? How adept was he as a vocalist?
Well, the same. I maybe would have done a couple of extra takes with Noel. I was never that convinced he should be singing. I didn't think he sounds as good as Liam.
Right.
Certainly not back then, you know. Liam was just such a great singer at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, he sang it, and I comped it, and I tuned it, and ever. So we had a vocal.
Yes.
The vocal we got.
Mm.
I was never that convinced it was that brilliant, really, but it kind of works, obviously, and people like it. So I always just thought Liam should have sang it.
Was Liam pissed off that he didn't?
No, at all. Liam was quite happy to have a break. He knew Noel wanted to sing one of them.
Yeah.
You know, so he'd sang three lead vocals in 3 days.
Yes.
He was quite happy to have a day off, really.
Right, okay.
And so Sally can wait. She knows it's too late as we're walking on by. My soul slides away. But don't look back in anger, I heard you say.
So then on the Friday, I think, on the Friday, Oasis used to work Monday to Friday, and everyone would sort of bugger off down the pub on a Friday night. So I think we started the backing track of Champagne Supernova on the Friday. We probably got to the stage of, you know, two basic acoustic guitars, drums, bass, boneheads, electric guitars, and a couple of Noel's guitars, and we probably left it there that day. Mm. I think I've said in the past that it was finished in one day, but it wasn't. Actually, Champagne Supernova took maybe 3 or 4 sessions.
Okay.
Because that Friday night was when Liam brought lots of people back from the pub.
Yeah.
And him and Noel had their bus stop or whatever.
Right, now, is this true that... Okay, let me read to you straight off, you know, one of the things I've read, so I'm not pretending I'm saying this. It says here... tension returned due to, well, because it's basically saying the younger Gallagher considered the fact that Don't Look Back in Anger was recorded by Noel, considered this tantamount to a temporary exile from his own group. The issue dissipated momentarily as Noel was pleased with Liam's vocal take of Wonderwall. However, tension returned due to Liam's strained attempts to sing the high notes on Champagne Supernova. When Noel subsequently took his turn to record his vocals for Don't Look Back in Anger, Liam went to a local pub and came back accompanied by a crowd of people while recording was still underway, infuriating his brother. The siblings then began fighting viciously. The session was abandoned and recording was suspended.
Now, that all sounds very fanciful journalism there.
Yeah, and it says, and then it says, when the Gallagher brothers were reconciled 3 weeks later, the group spent another 2 weeks working on the album.
Yeah, no, that's all bollocks. I mean, there's, you know, what I've told you is what happened.
Yeah, no, that's great. I want to get the real story here.
But Noel makes up his own history as well, you know, but that's very fanciful journalism. Liam had no problem with Noel singing Don't Look Back in Anger.
Right.
And the recording carried on. I think it was my birthday on the Friday, something like that.
Yeah, because you said they went down the pub, and then when they came
Well, Liam went down the pub. Me and Noel, I think, were still doing guitar overdubs on Champagne Supernova. This was like maybe 9 in the evening, something like that.
Yes.
And then I think me, Brian Cannon, and Noel decided, and Brian Cannon's their art director.
Yeah.
Who basically hung out the whole entire time. Mm. You know, he was a very funny bloke to have around.
Yeah.
Very cool in the studio. And we probably had a few drinks for the first time in the week.
Yeah.
And just had a listen back to what we'd done all week. I think no one came in the studio. Liam apparently turned back up at the accommodation part of Rockfield, which was about 500 yards away from the studio, with, you know, maybe 20 people, and you know, as people do, you know, and I think he was getting off with some girl and stuff, and I think me, Noel and Brian knocked it on the head about 1 a.m. in the studio, fairly drunk. We'd had to listen to the music and stuff, locked the studio up.
Yeah.
Went back to the accommodation. I went to my bed. I was exhausted.
Yeah.
From the week's work. I went straight to sleep. I missed all the aggro. But apparently Noel kicked off at Liam when he saw all these people sort of, you know, having a party in his accommodation.
Yeah.
Which upset Liam then, because Noel was like, get these fuckers out of here. And Liam's like, well, I just invited them back.
Yeah.
I think it was more that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's various stories of what happened after that. I don't think Liam trashed any of Noel's equipment. He couldn't get in the studio to do anything like that.
Right.
I think it was more all over Noel trying to get rid of Liam's supposed new friends and stuff.
Okay, so basically,
and Liam then,
sorry, go on. And Liam then what?
No, and Liam being angry at being told off by his older brother in front of people, you know.
Yeah.
And when Liam tried battering Noel's door down to, you know, fight him in front of these other people, that's when I think Noel got a cricket bat and hit Liam. Because Liam always came out worse, apparently, with their fights, you know, because Noel always battered him.
So basically, it wasn't over the music, as far as you know, at all.
No, not at all. No. Nothing to do with the music whatsoever. But then Noel buggered off, got Alan White to, like, drive me to London, because Liam had kicked his door in, right, you know, and I just remember waking up the next day and Liam looking very sheepish. He'd broken his foot, kicking the fucking door in. Noel had disappeared. You know, so everyone buggered off.
Yeah.
But it was a good week's work.
All in a
week's
work.
It was a brilliant
week's
work. Yeah. So Noel had a week off. Liam had a week off, you know, sort of. And it was about maybe 10 days later, you know, the week Monday later, that everyone reconvened.
Yeah.
And, you know, Liam and Noel had a big hug, and we just got on with it. Because they'd been breaking up regularly by then. I think it was just another brother argument, you know.
Oh, so it was only about a week anyway.
Yeah, it was 2 weekends plus the 5 day week, so it was about 10 days.
Yeah.
And like that, by the time Noel got back, you know, I think I went into Rockfield and had a muck around with keyboards and stuff and just sort of tidied up and stuff, you know.
And all the other guys, where were the other guys, the other band members?
Oh, they all buggered off on one, but everybody was planning to go away for the weekend anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so they were planning to work Monday to Friday and then bugger off.
Yes.
Anyway, they just buggered off for a bit longer.
Right.
You know, until they calmed down.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
There was no way they weren't going to come back and finish the record, you know, so...
And how was it when they did get back? I mean, was there an atmosphere?
Oh, totally fine, you know, there wasn't an atmesphere at all.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, they had their hug and everybody just got on with it, you know.
Brilliant stuff. All right, so now where do you pick up with the track? What do you do next?
Well, I can't remember exactly when we picked up the Champagne Supernova, because we were also starting other tracks like She's Electric and Hey Now we decided to do, and Morning Glory.
Yeah.
But some night that week, or some day that week, Noel would have decided to carry on with his guitar overdubs.
Yes.
That would have been the first thing. And he sat down and he did, I think, there were things like those Evos, there's two Evos that go throughout it, doing a sort of violin-y kind of descending thing, da-da-da-da, that go all the way. He did those pretty quick, and then he did all his picking parts pretty quick. And I remember him in there for about 2 hours, and he'd just sit in the studio next to his amps and play, and I'd record, and just layer it up. And he wouldn't come in and listen back. He'd just stay in there until it's done. So it was done fairly quickly, all the guitar overdubs, all the first bit of guitar overdubs, not the lead guitar.
Yeah.
And then I think Liam had a go at singing it.
Yes.
Now, this is where your story might be confused, because Liam sang Champion Supernova twice.
Yeah.
So we did what we normally do. We did the four, or maybe even half a dozen, takes. But what was happening was the high note on Champion Supernova, on the sort of people believe that they're going to get away from the summer.
Yes.
But the end of that bit, that high note was kind of burning his voice out.
Yeah.
So he was kind of getting croakier on each take.
Mm.
So by the time he got to the end of the song, he was sounding very Rod Stewart-y. but we did a comp. I did a comp of it, and Noel liked it.
Yeah.
Bizarrely enough.
Yeah.
And Liam liked it, yeah. But I didn't.
Uh-huh.
At the very end of the session in Rockfield, at the very end of the 6 weeks, with just me and Liam in the studio, I got Liam to re-sing it, and we did it piece by piece. We did the very first verse.
How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high? Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high?
Like half a dozen times.
Right.
And we did the very ending half a dozen times.
Yeah.
How many special people change? How many lives to live is strange? Where were you while we were getting high? We were getting high. 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 We were getting high.
So we did all the softest bits first, kind of built it up in sections.
Yeah.
And once he got all his soft bits done, we did like the first chorus a bunch of times.
Mm.
And then into the second verse, and then got all the choruses done. So the high bits we did last, so he could burn his voice out on those then.
Yeah.
But we could still construct something that sounded... That went back down to a softer bit of singing at the end without sounding all croaky.
Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova in the sky. Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova, a champagne supernova. 'Cause people believe that they're gonna get away for the summer. But you and I will live and die. The world's still spinning round. We don't know why. Why?
So that was another session. That was the last session in Rockfield on Champion Supernova. There was another session on Champion Supernova somewhere in the middle where Liam got kind of really drunk and did all the R's. And all the sort of Beatley on the guitar solo.
Yeah.
I think I put some like Beatley mellotrons and stuff like that on. I don't know how much of that stuff stayed, but
he got drunk and then did this, and you thought, oh, that's cool, or he got drunk.
He got drunk, and I sort of had the inspiration for doing it. I think. It was one of those nights where we were listening back to stuff and. And he was like, oh, I want to go in there and do some Beatles R's. And so, you know, having the having the luxury of all the tracks, you could put lots of stuff down.
Yes.
You know, so Champagne Supernova was mostly finished. Mm. Noel put a little bit of lead guitar down, but I think he wanted Paul Weller to do the lead guitar on it.
Now, again, was that something that, as far as you know, was that something that he'd always intended, that he wanted to have Paul Weller on this track?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Mm. I think he'd said from the start that he wanted Weller on one of the tracks, and this was the place for him to do a solo.
I mean, was he already in with Weller or something? You know, that they'd already...
Oh, God, yeah. Mm. Yeah, they were kind of big mates straight away, I think.
Yes.
And, I mean, Noel was a big fan.
Yeah.
And I think they'd met quite a few times.
Yes.
You know, at Glastonbury and stuff like that, and I think they just got on very well.
Yeah.
So I think it was quite definite that he was going to play on it.
Yes.
Which happened then after the Rockfield session finished, which would be about mid-June. Mm. They went off and did Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And after Glastonbury, we went to Orinoco in Elephant Castle, or near Elephant Castle.
Yeah, London, yeah.
To mix it.
Yeah.
Which is a great mixing room. It had a big Neve back then, same sort of Neve. Great Montrin, loads of outboard.
Yeah.
It was a bit in the middle of nowhere, but that was all right. And we kind of settled there. We were there for like 6 weeks, I think. And they just let us get on with it. And I think Paul Weller came down one day, is all, and he did the guitar solo on Champagne Supernova fairly quickly.
Yeah. How did you record him? Do you remember?
Oh, Christ, that was easy. That was so easy. He brought his roadie with him. He was playing some white SG.
Yeah.
And he had an old Vox AC30. And he didn't use any pedals. He had, you know, the volume on 3 or something, you know, it was a really nice box and a really nice SG, and it sounded magnificent. I probably just put a 57 on it and just recorded it as was.
Yeah.
You know, because it was a very, again, very quick recording session, you know, and well, he probably did 4 solos and then let me pick what I preferred from it, and Noel let me pick as well.
Also overdubbed some harmonica on a couple of tracks.
He did that on the Swamp Song.
Okay.
I don't think it was on anything else. I think it was just the Swamp Song.
Okay.
Yeah.
By the way, what guitars, you know, were being played generally on that album? I mean,
Bowen had always used his sort of Epiphone 335 copy thing, whatever it's called. I can't remember what they call it.
Right.
Noel had one of those as well. Noel had quite a few. Noel sort of swapped around.
Not Epiphone Casino, was it?
It might have been. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I can never remember the names of them.
Yeah.
But Noel had a couple of those, and he also had, you know, a couple of Les Pauls.
Yeah.
He probably had a Strat and a Telly-Round, which he never really used, I don't think, at the time.
Mm.
So it was all Gibsons, really.
Yeah.
And his amp setup was like an AC30, and a couple of Marshall combos and an orange, I think he had around at the time as well. Oh, we also used to have this very funny little Wem combo, which was good for picking, I seem to remember. And we generally use a combination of amps for every overdub, like a couple of amps, so I'd have options later on for tones.
Hmm. Was that both Bonehead and Noel?
Bonehead probably just used the one guitar and the one amp the entire time. and I'd probably just track it up just for sort of thickening the sound or widening it if I needed.
Yes. Yeah. What amp did Bonehead use?
I think it was like a Marshall combo. Well, I can't remember what they were called. Those Marshall combos, Blues Breakers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to forgive my memory. For
no, it's okay. I can change that out.
Names of things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just the one amp all the time with Bonehead. You know, he was happy with it, so that was his sound, really.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Now, were there any more string overdubs to be done?
No, not on that. Not on Morning Glory. I did all the strings on that album.
Okay.
So there were no real session players on that record.
Right.
It was all Kurzweil or Mellotron.
I see. Okay. Okay. Pretty convincing sounding, actually, I must say.
Well, the Mellotron's good, and the Kurzweil was very good as well,
yeah.
You see. They had a lot of character,
yes.
Those keyboards.
Yes.
I mean, it was an old Kurzweil that had basically two string sounds and a piano sound on it.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of the original sort of sampling keyboards. So it definitely had atmosphere.
Yeah, because that cello sound is pretty convincing, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but that's just a standard Mellotron that's on a lot of records, I think.
Yes.
It just gets a good air in there. comes in a good place.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all very happy when, you know, first tried it. It was like, oh, fuck, that's good.
Yes.
So that sort of stuff works. But I generally sort of put the Mellotron down first and then layer the Kurzweil behind to add a bit of depth.
Right.
It's very, very, very basic stuff, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So, anything else? Was that it?
Keyboard-wise, or anything like that, or guitar? Well, I can't think.
Any more work on that album?
No, I mean the mixing. There was no more recording on it, and the mixing, they kind of left down to me.
Mm.
Noel would come along and sort of generally want the guitar solo turned up.
Mm.
You know, I'd start the mixing. If I wanted to remix anything, that would be my decision.
Mm.
The mix we used in Wonderwall, I actually did at Rockfield one day when I was kind of feeling bored. So there's like a 3-hour mix of Wonderwall. I remixed it at Orinoco, but it was never the same.
Huh.
So I decided to use this mix from Rockfield.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Today was gonna be the day they were gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you got to do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Morning Glory took on a life of its own after Wonderwall, and then Don't Look Back in Anger came consecutively as singles. Then it just blew up all over the world.
There are many things that I would like to say to you, but I don't know how. I don't know how. Except maybe.
The songs on that record, they're extraordinary songs. And they're not extraordinary songs because of anything that I did. I only wrote them, and we only played them. It's the millions of people since who fucking sing them back to you to this day that have made them extraordinary.
Today was gonna be the day, but they'll never throw it back to you. By now, you should have somehow realized what you're not to do. About you now.
There's nothing better than singing them songs, man, to the people. Fucking blast their souls and them just going fucking apeshit.
And all the lights that light the way are blinding. There are
Yeah, we had a lot of freedom. I mean, we had total freedom. It was good. It was a very easy session.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there were no record companies demanding remixes or interfering or wanting things changed at all.
So actually, everything on Wonderwall was really, what we hear, was all done at Rockfield.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are things like, you know, Rockfield had these amazing real echo chambers that were off in these cow sheds somewhere with old Tannoy speakers going to these old, you know, through these old valve amps, going to these old valve mics that Kingsley had put in there in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And they'd be on the desk, these reverb sends. So part of the sound is that. It kind of gets a bit swirly near the end. I think I was feeding some of my keyboards into it, and it had this atmosphere. Really nice stuff.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, because obviously you worked with them again, how does, you know, that project match up to everything else that you did with them and generally within the context of your whole career, those sessions?
Oh, well, it all went a bit downhill after that, really. Most Glory was very easy.
Yes.
You know, everybody wanted to be there, which makes it nice.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's energy was good about it.
Mm.
And then we did another good session, I think, just before the album came out, where we recorded the master plan.
Right.
And I think that was our last good, great session, really.
Mm.
Be Here Now was a horrible session because Noel didn't want to be there, Liam didn't want to be there.
Mm.
None of the band wanted to be there, I don't think.
Mm.
But there was so much money flying around that they couldn't refuse, really. I think they should have, you know, taken some time off. But that was quite an ordeal, you know, as compared to the 6 weeks of some joy in a Rockfield. You know, it was 10 months of pulling teeth, really.
Which was
a shame, and it was down to, you know, people's attitudes and desires, really. And things have changed by then, you know.
Yes.
There's so much money around, and the paparazzi around, and there's all attention on them. And no songs were maybe not as good as before. My production, it all went a bit wrong, really.
Yeah.
Morning Glory was a definite high, certainly for me, with Oasis, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some, you know, pretty effusive quotes by you about that project. You know, I mean, for instance, I've got one here. You said, yeah, when it was finished, you said the album would wipe the field of any competition. It's astonishing. It's the bollocks for this decade.
I'm not sure if I said that, to be honest. I think when that NME blur thing was going on, some NME journalists rang me up sort of unexpectedly. I probably had a few beers or something, so I probably talked a lot of rubbish at the time as well.
But we were
all very excited about it at the time. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, now looking back on those sessions, you know, how do you feel about those?
Well, the sessions were brilliant. I don't know how great my recordings are. I think my recordings get away with it. They're very basic, my recordings.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing fancy about the production at all. I think I get away with it down because of the songs and because of the, you know, performance, like Liam's performances.
Right.
Which is why it's a record that people still like.
Yes.
You know, but then a year later, they became a horrible band to record, so, you know, it's a very movable thing.
Yeah.
But that session was lovely.
Yes.
Great, great fun. I had brilliant fun with Oasis for about a year, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they were a lot of fun to be around, very positive place to be.
Yes. Now, tell me about the brick wall mastering technique.
I'm not sure how good that is either. I remastered Electronics first album about 6 months before I was Definitely Maybe.
Yeah.
And and an electronic's first album had been mastered by someone many years ago, and it was bloody awful. Sounded terrible. So I thought I'd have a go at it myself, and Johnny Marr and Bertie Summer let me have a go at it myself in Johnny Marr's studio, and I hired in a set of the Apogee A to Ds, which were on the market at the time, which had a soft limit function. So you can basically crank up the volume into them without digital distortion.
Yeah.
You can go up, you know, another 612 dB. So that was my brick walling technique. But I mastered Definitely Maybe in the same way. So it was more volume, it was more quantity rather than quality, really, was my theory, because I was very insecure about my mixes.
Yes.
Because I wasn't really technically that adept, you know, I wasn't a Mark Stent or, you know,
right,
a Bob Trier mounted mixing type sort of person. I was technically quite illiterate.
Yeah.
So the mastering gave me the opportunity to just bump the volume up, really, to make them sort of, so when it came on, it didn't sound too embarrassing, it actually sort of sounded loud and proud.
We were out touring and we would be in the back of the van and the cassettes would turn up by courier from our office, and it'd be mixed a slide away and we'd all stick it on. And it's the only time we've actually given something away to mix and not been involved in any of the mixing. And he sent it back and we were just going, fucking, that's it.
Yeah.
Who is he? You know. So I was going to find out as well, so it's a bit of a disappointment. But...
first I ever heard was a tape, and amazing. Owen just smoothed it all out, really. It still had that rawness, but that kind of professional touch to it as well.
It's really about the fucking guitars at the end of the day, you know, not just because I play them, you know, because that's what it's about. Well, I remember him phoning up Marcus and saying, there's one song here, it's got 17 guitar solos on it, all going at the same time. And Marcus is phoning me going, which one of these is the one? I was like, fucking all of them. What are you talking about, man? Come on.
That was the theory there. And I did a similar thing on Morning Glory. And after that, I thought I'd better stop doing it. Because there's only so loud you can go.
Yeah.
So I let someone else master.
Was that in light of the whole sort of volume wars with Blur?
No, well, there wasn't a volume war with Blur. I mean, Blur was making, you know, Stephen Street was making well-polished, nice-sounding records, and mine were just these sort of blunt slabs of guitars and vocals.
Yeah.
good-sounding blunt guitars and vocals.
Yeah. I've got a quote of yours here from 2010 that says, "The sessions were the best, easiest, least fraught, most happily creative time I've ever had in a recording studio. I believe people can feel and hear when music is dishonest and motivated by the wrong reasons. Morning Glory, for all its imperfection and flaws, is dripping with love and happiness."
Oh, that doesn't sound bad. That sounds like the sort of thing I'd write, yeah.
But, I mean, do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
No, very much. It was a lovely time. It was a good time.
Yes.
And the music is good. The music is nice, you know.
Oh, it is. It's fantastic.
And it is full of imperfections. Massively so.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, my two favourite tracks are Don't Look Back in Anger and Champagne Supernova on that album. I just love those tracks.
Yeah, Champagne Supernova's good. I don't look back in anger. I'm confused. It was never that special to record. Maybe it was very easy to record. So I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Like some might say, I think that's an interesting thing.
Right. Yeah.
I think I like his words on that.
Yes.
I like it's a real mess of a recording. It's a total disaster of a recording, which I quite like as well.
Yeah.
It was all quite interesting. It was good time.
Yeah. What have you been doing recently?
My latest band I'm recording is Madness.
Really?
Of all bands. Yeah.
Wow.
No, I just did 5 tracks on their new album. And it's brilliant. They're going to have a number one album this year.
Really? Fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful music. Stephen Street's done two tracks.
Yeah.
I've done five.
Yeah.
I think Clive Langer's might have done a couple.
Yeah, I was going to ask if Langer and Winstanley did anything. Yeah.
Well, I think Winstanley stopped. Clive Langer's done one or two, I think.
I see.
Certainly one. And it's brilliant. It's going to be a lovely rest. That's my latest. That's my latest known band. I mean, there's a couple of unsigned. There's lots of unsigned guitar bands around at the moment, which is a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
You know, there's a band called Towns who I've been recording, who are brilliant, and a Scottish band called Staggerat. So it's just getting people to, you know, put money behind these guitar bands at the moment.
Yeah.
It's a bit difficult in England at the moment. In Britain.
Yeah.
But Survivors, but Madness is fabulous. Yeah, really enjoying that.
Where have you been working with them?
We recorded at Metropolis.
Okay.
Which was lovely. Just had a nice big room, and you know, I've been mixing at my house in Edinburgh.
Okay.
And overdubbing at various places.
Yeah.
Passing them when I can, really.
Yes.
But it's a really good album. It'll be out in October, I think.
I'm glad to hear that. I saw them again at the closing ceremonies of the Olympics. It was great to see them.
Yeah, they're brilliant. They're very competitive and very creative.
Yeah.
They all write. Every member of the band writes songs.
Wow.
And it's lovely. The music's brilliant. I mean, it's not going to be, on Radio 1, but it'll be a number one record.
Yeah.
It'll be successful.
Oh, I'm going to listen out for that. That's great. Good.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Yeah.
Misery loves company. That's what the wise man said. Don't come to me for sympathy if you can't raise your head. Stand up and see what your life could be if you wore a smile instead. If you keep misery as your company, then you might as well be dead. Why don't you go and suck on a silver spoon? Buy a spaceship and fly over.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that, and thank you very much to Richard Buskin for allowing me to put that out as part of the Oasis podcast. Make sure you are following Richard at Rich Buskin on Twitter, and he's on Facebook, just Richard Buskin. And make sure you're following his podcast, which is called Swinging Through the 60s. It's a fantastic podcast. Or if you didn't hear it, check out last episode where we talk all about it. So that will do it for today. Thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast. And a special thanks, as ever, to our patrons who put your money where your mouth is. Your support is greatly appreciated. You can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where I post articles by myself and my wonderful contributors. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Oasis Podcast. Email at oasispod@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys and I always reply, so please do get in touch. T-shirts and other merch are available at TeePublic. And please, a really good way to help out is to make sure you're giving us reviews on iTunes. So, as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.